Hanselminutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 372, recorded live Thursday, May 16th, 2013. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at telerik.com. And by franklins.net, makers of Gesture Pack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Troy Hunt about the state of web security.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I've got security guy Troy Hunt on the phone. How are you?
Hey, Scott, I'm really good, thanks.
Have you broken into anyone's Wi-Fi today?
No, not today, but it's still early yet, so we will see how it pans out.
I've been freaking out since I've been reading your stuff about Wi-Fi and breaking into it. I mean, I knew that WEP, W-E-P, is not a good way to, you know, kind of set up my Wi-Fi, and I've gone to my parents' house, and I've changed them from WP to WPA to, and anytime I see a neighbor or a family member or a friend, I switch them over, but I'm still a little concerned. How insecure is Wi-Fi?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting question. I mean, I'm like you. We've sort of moved through the WEP era and we're into the WPA2 era. And I think, to be honest, as a consumer and particularly as a home user, you know, that's about the best we can do today. We pick WPA2 and we try and have a nice strong passcode on it so it can't be too easily brute forced. So that's easy. I mean, I guess the more interesting bit is what happens with all of our devices that are still trying to connect to unsecured networks. And that's where some of the research I've been doing has been hitting. That's the thing that keeps me awake.
Mm-hmm. But what do I tell my wife? What do I tell the non-technical person? I want to get a sense of the paranoia slider bar and where should I be and where should my family be?
So I think there's two sides to look at it. So in terms of, for those of us setting up access points, I mean, we've got WPA2 and again, you know, we put a strong passcode on that and that's about the best we can do. But the other side of it is what other networks are our devices connecting to? Because what a lot of people don't realize is that when we connect to an access point, our device then walks around broadcasting this little probe signal looking for that access point again in the future. Now, when that access point that you've connected to may have been insecure, so no WEP, no WPA, just an open network, that's where we start to get a real risk because we can have these other nasty, sneaky devices, which is the sort of thing I've been writing about, stand up and say, hey, I'm the access point that you're looking for, come on board, and they connect and they have a little relationship, and as far as the device knows, it's talking to a known network.
Okay, so hang on a second. You're saying that rather than maintaining a list of my favorite access points, my preferred access points, and then simply attaching to one when it sees it, which seems like a fairly harmless and passive thing, that all the Wi-Fi devices in the world actively announce who they're looking for?
Yeah, so what's happening, and you know, whether it's your phone or your tablet or your PC, when you make an association to a wireless access point, the way the device reconnects when you come home and you walk in the front door is the device is sending out these little probe requests and is saying, hey, is my network there? Is it there? The access point receives the probe request and responds and says, hey, I'm the guy you're looking for. And that's when the association happens. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. And there's obviously like a massive convenience factor to be able to just walk home and things work. Where it gets interesting is that if one of those access points had no security whatsoever, there is a vulnerability where another device, and this is this pineapple thing I've been writing about, can go and actually spoof that SSID. So it can say, hey, I'm, you know, Scott's home. Welcome on board. Let's connect. And because there is no handshake, there's no sort of authentication process, the association is made. And that's the really interesting risk.
But how does it know? So what is the protocol that is faulty here that is saying that, you know, let's say Hanselman is the SSID that I want? Like, how do they know? Like, I can understand if someone is parked in a van out front of my house broadcasting free Wi-Fi that someone might connect to that because, hey, free Wi-Fi. But how would they ever know that my device wants Hanselman?
Yeah, and of course that would be an explicit action if you saw free Wi-Fi and you said, hey, I want to get on board with this, let's go and grab some. So how the device knows, or how the rogue access point, if you like, and that's probably the best word to use it. So say an attacker says, look, I want to try and get Scott to connect to my access point without any explicit action whatsoever. When you walk past with your phone is saying, where is the Hanselman SSID? Where is the Hanselman SSID? And it keeps sending out this probe request. Now, the device, the rogue device, can detect this probe request, and it can say, hey, I'm going to change my SSID so it reads Hanselman. Now, if your phone wasn't expecting to make an authenticated request or wasn't expecting to sort of go through an authentication handshake, i.e. it was an open network, no credentials, that's right. When the association is made. So that's where the risk is. And the real story to your original question about how do we as consumers protect our devices, the simple answer is don't connect to unprotected networks because that's where this risk comes from. So even if you go to the airport and, hey, there's airport free Wi-Fi, you'll then go somewhere else with your phone and your phone's saying, hey, where's the airport free Wi-Fi? And if a rogue access point can receive that and say, well, I'm going to tell you that I'm the airport free Wi-Fi, that's when your problem comes.
I see. So if I went to the airport and someone knew I was going to be there, could they have a Hanselman honeypot waiting for me? Or that's not a problem because Hanselman is not a open Wi-Fi point?
Well, I think you're probably right on both fronts. So, you know, like me, you've probably got WPA2 protection. So the device is expecting to authenticate. It's expecting to go through this, they call this four-way handshake, which is part of the 802.11 protocol. And it's not going to happen because the access point isn't going to be able to complete its side of that authentication process. But they don't have to sort of be there waiting for you. I mean, if you go to any busy place and turn on one of these rogue access points, you'll see all of these probes come from, you know, hundreds and hundreds of probes come from people around you looking for these access points.
Yikes. Okay, so then the solution is never ever connect to anything that is not authenticated that I control?
Yeah, pretty much. Or if you do, forget that network because it's the automatic association. And even then, forgetting the network, it depends on the device. So something like an iOS device, it's easy to forget a network when you can see it. When you can't see it, you can't forget it because you've got to be able to select a network which is currently in range. So for something like iOS, you've then got to sort of go back and delete all your network settings. If you're on a Mac or a PC, at least you can go and see all of the devices, or rather all of the wireless access points that you've previously connected to, and you can sort of, you know, selectively nuke them, and they tell you, you know, was this access point secured or not.
Right, but on Windows 8, that dialogue is gone. The wireless settings dialogue you used to be able to get to is gone. You can't delete old networks anymore.
Oh, really? So, you know, I hadn't looked at 8. I know that previously we couldn't. I know you can on OS X, but yeah, that is interesting because that then puts you back in the iOS category where your only option then is to say, well, I just got to delete everything.
Right. Because on Windows, you can right-click and say open network settings. Here, you can say network and sharing center. But on the left-hand side, it used to say change adapter settings, change advanced sharing settings, and then there was one for Wi-Fi. That's gone now in Windows 8.
Interesting. I wonder if it still exists under the covers somewhere and you've just got to, you know, register.
You know, we should look into that because if there's a way to maybe launch that dialog box programmatically, just like the dialog is there, but it's been hidden away, because that would be really interesting. Because I have seen times where I've had, 40, 50 Wi-Fi points from all the airports all over the world just sitting there.
Yeah, and you know, that's the really weird thing too, because you go back to somewhere you haven't been for a while and you look down and you go, hey, I got signal. You know, what's going on? Was I here before?
Right. So it sounds like removing automatic association completely would be a good start. Like it's a convenience, but it's that implicit action that gets us into trouble.
Well, you know, it depends on the context because I want to be able to come home each day and I'm connected. I want that to work. That's a convenience that has a security aspect to it because I trust my home network. But I also want to be able to maybe use a public network somewhere, be selective about the services I use, and then not have it automatically reconnect if I'm stopped in the traffic out the front of the McDonald's or something like that.
If I go, now I've always had people say I should use SSL and HTTPS for all of my logins. And a couple of years ago, maybe 18 months ago, Twitter and Facebook and Google and a lot of people just switched to HTTPS by default. And, you know, certainly if you're logging in somewhere and you're about to hit submit and it's not under HTTPS, then you probably have a problem. That's not somewhere you want to spend time with. But if I have connected to one of these honeypots, or if I am associated with an evil rogue network, that HTTPS may not matter, would it? It may not save me.
Yeah, so here's the interesting thing. And for me, looking at Wi-Fi is not because I want to break people's networks. It's because from a developer security perspective, I'm interested in what is the risk to web applications when the connection can't be trusted. So, you know, you're right insofar as HTTPS is really the key there. And really HTTPS is there to save us. In fact, HTTPS is there to do several things, but one of the key things is it's there to save us when we can't necessarily trust the transport layer. So if you are connected to a rogue access point, is that web application sufficiently implementing HTTPS that if someone is able to intercept your traffic, they're not able to do evil with it?
Okay. What if they are using one of these new devices? You've been talking about this Wi-Fi pineapple. What is this?
Yeah, so the pineapple is this little piece of equipment that's making things quite interesting for me. So the pineapple is a little device. It's about the size of a cigarette pack. They sell it for $100. You get it from the Hack5 shop online. It is sold for quote-unquote penetration testing purposes. I suspect it's not always used for penetration purposes or penetration inspection detection purposes. So, you know, the thing about the pineapple, it's a little device that again, it's quite small. It has an aerial, so it's got its own Wi-Fi access point. It's got an Ethernet port, and it runs a little version of OpenWRT embedded Linux. And it's really its own little computer, which is able to perform the sort of activities we were talking about before with regards to rogue access points. So, for example, when I turn the pineapple on, and you can power it by battery, so you can just chuck it in your pocket or your bag or something, it will start looking for these probe requests from devices. So if you walk past and your device says, hey, I'm trying to connect to free airport Wi-Fi in Seattle, This device will get that and it will say, okay, well, I'm going to turn around and I'm going to tell Scott that I am free Wi-Fi, you know, free airport Wi-Fi in Seattle, and I'm going to allow that association to happen. Now, if an attacker can then route the traffic that you are sending to that device through to an actual open internet connection, so for example, if we take that Ethernet port, plug it into your laptop with connection sharing, we can now route your traffic through the device. So this device becomes a man in the middle. And when it's a man in the middle, it can see any unprotected traffic that you're sending. So there's sort of a confidentiality risk. It can manipulate any unprotected traffic you're sending. So there's an integrity risk. It can maybe change the path or change the form action of a logon form. And really, it can pretty much mess with anything you send across that connection.
Wow. Okay. But is it not a Wi-Fi point, or it is a Wi-Fi point in the middle? It's just there to be evil.
Yeah, correct. It's a Wi-Fi point in the middle. And in fact, one way you can use it is just as a normal Wi-Fi access point. So, you know, to your earlier example, you could set it up to have an SSID that it broadcasts, which just says, hey, I'm free Wi-Fi. And if you go somewhere that's busy enough with enough people, like a, you know, a cafe where people want to sit and browse, and they open up their wireless connections and they go, hey, there's free Wi-Fi and it's not protected. We'll just jump on that. Now, what they don't realize is that any services they're connecting to, whether that be via the browser or maybe any apps talking to back-end web services, if those services don't have a proper implementation of HTTPS, then they can be intercepted and they can be manipulated.
Wow. Is this something that I should... Does this only exist to be evil?
The pineapple itself? Well, again, the theory is it's for penetration testers. And I think it's... Look, it's really a question of intent. So for me, I'm not evil with it. For me, I'm using that to then write about... When you don't follow particular good practices in your web development, this is the way it can be exploited. Mm-hmm. So for me, the value proposition is that this helps materialize a risk that I think for many people is very conceptual. You know, a lot of people say, hey, it's just, you know, we're just sending some cookies around and it's not over HTTPS. Can it really be exploited? And this is the little tool that helps me do that. Now, of course, other people might go along to the airport or the coffee shop and proxy people's traffic through and capture all the packets they possibly can and harvest credentials. So, you know, there's definitely potential for misuse.
So speaking as a technical person who, you know, wants to be safe on the web, and maybe this is beyond the average Joe and their abilities, but should I be using VPN? Should I be paying a VPN company for security on top of security? Should I be VPNing back into my home and then surfing from there, or purchasing a private network, or even running my own Linode instance and doing proxying through that.
Yeah, well, VPNs is one thing that certainly fixes this. It fixes it insofar as if there were websites that would otherwise leave you vulnerable, at least if you have an encrypted network between your device and an endpoint somewhere else that is trusted, you know, you've got that security. So if someone's sitting there on the Wi-Fi in the middle, they're not going to be able to gain access to that traffic. And certainly there are tools around. I mean, there are products like Cloak I've been hearing a bit about lately, which is designed to run on devices such as iPhones and tablets and whatever else it may be, where you can say, hey, I'm going to connect to a network, and whether I trust it or not, I'm going to turn on Cloak, turn on the VPN, and then we're going to be safe at least until it gets to whatever endpoint Cloak has somewhere in their own servers.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that something like Tor, or is Cloak different from Tor? Because Cloak is a paid project. That's a company that you pay the money. And Tor is more of a distributed kind of elite thing.
Yeah, and Tor is really more about anonymizing than anything. So, you know, we particularly see Tor used for political dissidents or other people wanting to do evil things where they really want to obfuscate identity. And my understanding is that Tor also has some pretty serious limitations in terms of speed and capacity as well. So it's kind of a different use case, but certainly in the case of where we're talking about, hey, and I'm going to be cautious the way I say it, I want to use a network where I may not trust everyone between myself and the target service that I'm hitting, you know, that's a good VPN case. And that's not about I want to hide my identity. It's about, hey, I want to protect my traffic.
Mm-hmm. But if I'm just using Gmail and connecting to my work's Outlook and surfing the web, does it matter if someone's watching? I mean, if I'm over Gmail and I look at my certs in the browser and it looks legit, do I have anything to worry about?
Well, I mean, this is what sort of brings us back around to the fact that this is really only a risk that is exploited when web applications are not properly protecting the traffic. And Gmail certainly does a good job of that. I mean, these guys do know a thing or two about securing web applications. And it's the same if you're using Outlook.com. It's the same if you're using most banks, with some exceptions. It's not too bad when you're using applications that implement things correctly. And that's the real trick. And again, why I've even got the pineapple to begin with. Yeah, are we getting our HTTPS right in our applications to begin with?
Okay. So what is the obvious thing that, you know, some startup who has launched today, they're taking a break, they're listening to Hansel Minutes, and they forgot to do what?
Yeah, well, there's a few common patterns. And, you know, obviously the first one is that when you send anything of any sensitive nature across the web, whether you're sending it to the server or you're receiving it back in the other way, you do want to send that across a protected connection. So, you know, if you're not logging in and seeing a padlock icon in your address bar and that doesn't sort of load up and show a valid certificate, you know, that would be a problem. But that's pretty low-hanging fruit. I think most people tend to get that right. Where things start to be a little bit more gray is there's a few patterns that we seem to keep seeing again where people think they're secure, but they really pose a risk. And a really good example is often you'll see logon forms that are loaded over HTTP, so there it's an unencrypted connection, mm-hmm. And then the form action is an HTTPS address. And I've seen a lot of cases where people sort of bring this to their attention. So someone will tweet a company and say, hey, guys, you know, you're not protecting your form. And they'll come back and they'll say, aha, but we are, because when we post it, your password is protected when it is sent to our server. Now, the problem is that you do not know that it is actually sent to their server.
Right. Without doing a view source, how could you know?
Well, it's not just that. So, I mean, let's imagine that it is sent to their server and the form action is still the same. Mm-hmm. But because that form has been loaded over HTTP, some man in the middle, and well, let's be gender agnostic, somebody in the middle has managed to inject script into that page. And that script is going to take your credentials and also send them off to an attacker's server. Now, this sounds very hypothetical, but there was a case of this. In fact, there are many cases of it. One that was sort of very high profile is a couple of years ago when there was a lot of political uprising in Tunisia. Facebook was still serving logon forms over HTTP and posting mm-hmm. over HTTPS. And there were cases, documented cases, and we have the script to demonstrate this, where the Tunisian-owned ISPs were injecting script into that login page. So people were logging into Facebook, and it seemed just fine, But what they didn't realize is that the page had been manipulated, the login page, and their credentials were being siphoned off to the side as well.
Hmm. Okay. So what if I visit a page and I get those warnings that I ignore that say, some of the things on this page were not loaded securely?
Yeah. So, this is the, part of the problem. I think we sort of desensitize people a little bit to warnings at times because we do see them so frequently. So the one you're probably referring to there is what we'd refer to as mixed mode, mm-hmm. where you've got both HTTP and HTTPS on the page. So let's say, for example, you load a page and it is an HTTPS address and the page loads over HTTPS. Now that gives you confidence in the integrity of that page as returned by the request over HTTPS. So that's fine. Now the page then goes and puts jQuery on the page, but it requests it from the jQuery CDN hosted by Google and it requests it over HTTP. Now that's when you get the warning because the browser says, although this page loaded securely, it has got assets that have been embedded on the page that weren't loaded securely. Now the risk is, particularly with JavaScript, you got to ask yourself, if I could control the JavaScript on this page, and because it wasn't loaded securely, I might be able to do that, what evil could I do? So, if I could control the JavaScript, well, I can start accessing the DOM, turning things on and off, grabbing anything from cookies, changing link paths or form actions. You can do just about anything if you can control that JavaScript.
Interesting. So does that mean that I should use the protocol-less URL, where instead of saying HTTP or HTTPS, I say just //, and then I let the browser figure it out for newer browsers?
Yeah, so protocol relative URLs are a good way of fixing that. So, if we start looking at it from the developer side, what does the developer do? Avoiding explicit schemes when you're embedding any content. So, rather than saying my image source or my script source is http://, like you say, starting with a whack, which would be a protocol relative URL, which will then, you can then reference another domain. So you can say, googlecdn.com. And it will get it over HTTP when the page, the parent page, is loaded over HTTP, or HTTPS if it's loaded over a secure connection. So that's one option. And then if you're embedding content from your own site, just using relative URLs, starting the path with a WAC and then, directory and then asset name. So that fixes that. But the important thing is to avoid explicitly hard coding an HTTP address because that's where the problem comes from.
I've noticed people talking about package managers like NuGet and Gems and NPM, these package managers that developers use to go to a central location, a trusted central location, and download some stuff. And people have complained that, that's not using HTTPS. And then the guys who run the package manager system will switch that to use HTTPS, but they're not checking that it is in fact the SSL certificate that they wanted. How important is that? If I'm making a web services call or a connection to a location and I say, hey, I used HTTPS, what's the problem, right? I'm under SSL. How important is that? Not just certificate revocation, but certificate identity.
Yeah, it's a good question. And in fact, I see that a lot on mobile apps. So one of the things that I'll often do if I'm looking at mobile apps is I'll proxy it through Fiddler. So Fiddler is an HTTP proxy tool, free product, which you can run on your PC. Set up your wireless device to connect via that proxy and then inspect all of the traffic that goes from your wireless device across the network. So I'll configure that and then you'll fire up an app that should send data securely, but you see this data appearing in Fiddler because Fiddler is able to issue its own self-signed certificate. So it's not a valid certificate issued by a valid certificate authority. It's just a way of, like you say, sort of keeping an HTTPS connection. Now, a lot of apps, like some of the banking apps, for example, and banks are usually pretty good at this sort of thing, they'll basically just drop the connection on the device. They'll say, hey, look, we can't get through, because inevitably they're validating the certificate. They're making sure that it is legitimate for that particular domain. Some of them will even validate the signature on the certificate and make sure that it actually reconciles to the one that was originally issued. So they have sort of a further verification process. But the worrying bit is some of these apps will simply say, let's make an HTTPS connection. Regardless of what happens with the certificate, let's just accept whatever comes back. Now, I'm sure that that made it really easy during development time because you could self-sign and you didn't have to worry about any of this sort of stuff. But to your point, it still sort of allows a man to get in the middle and say, hey, well, I'm just going to send you whatever old certificate I like, and if your app isn't actually validating that it's correct, then you've got a problem.
Right. So in that instance, you're trusting that the communication is secure, but you have no idea who you're talking to.
Yeah, pretty much. Because all you're doing is saying, hey, it's HTTPS, it must be good. But there's no actually, you know, there's not really a process of saying, is the certificate good? And that's something our browsers do by default, and that's great. But a lot of the time with mobile apps, people do configure them that way. And I'm sure it's the same, you know, when we're sort of connecting through to package managers. If there's not an explicit process of saying, hey, are we happy with this certificate, that's when we've got a problem.
It seems like it's a problem with HTTPS and SSL as a concept for the users that they think it means security and it means privacy. And trying to explain that to a user is pretty difficult.
You know, I look at it as meaning several different things, and this probably doesn't make it a whole lot easier for users either. But the first way I look at it is that it is authenticity. So if we can get a valid certificate back and we can inspect it and we know that it's issued by the site that we're connecting to it, you know, it's got their information and certificate, that gives us confidence of who we're connecting to. So there's your authenticity. Mm-hmm. The other side is the integrity. So, you know, moving beyond just privacy, how can I have confidence that the information on the page hasn't been changed? Now, that doesn't always mean that it's going to be sensitive information. It may just simply be that we want to have a high degree of confidence as a website owner, and maybe you could sort of pick some government examples, you know, it could be a good case for this, where the data hasn't been manipulated. So it's this integrity piece as well. And then there's the third piece, which is what you've just mentioned in terms of privacy as well. And I think that's what most people expect to see from it. They expect to see privacy. But there is also this assumption, like you say, where if I can see a padlock in the address bar, that means we have security. And it's really a little bit misleading, and it's kind of a difficult concept to explain to people too, isn't it? Where, hey, look, it actually means these very particular technical constructs. It doesn't mean that everything you do on this website is going to be super safe.
Right. Well, people watch, you know, laymans watch spy movies and someone says, is this a secure line? You know, they're not saying, does this line have security, integrity, privacy? It's, you know, they just, oh, it's a secure line, so we're cool. And I remember when browser toolbars and browser address bars turned green, you know, about 10 years ago, and the high trust? What was the name of those? EVSSL.
The extended validation certificates.
Yes, extended validation certificates. And I remember myself personally going to banks all over the U.S. convincing them that they needed to get those certificates. They're super expensive, and they basically involve someone visiting your data center and proving that you're real people, and there's a lot of faxing and just generally going around and around to prove that you're who you say you are. But I feel like other than the large, you know, kind of the top 100 sites plus banks, most people don't take the time to get those certificates, so they're really quite useless.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, actually. I heard someone say recently that the extended validation certificates were getting a lot cheaper, and it's a little bit odd because, like you say, there's a sort of a very extensive identity verification process that you go through with that. But then on the other hand, SSL itself is getting a lot cheaper. I mean, you can go to somewhere like Start SSL now and literally get a free SSL certificate. So I guess it stands to reason that the EV certs may be coming down a bit in price as well.
Which is a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, if it's easy to prove that I am someone, perhaps I'll just prove that I'm a Microsoft, except I'll misspell it.
Yeah, so I guess it's a question of does the reduction in price indicate that there's a reduction in due diligence, or is it simply that they're being more competitive and, you know, now it's more highly available to a broader range of people, which I guess if it's done right is a good thing. But like you say, you know, we don't want to sort of make it easy for people to go in and spoof identities or claim to be people that they are not.
Right. I mean, I would like, as the kind of the owner of Hanselman.com, to give visitors a sense of appreciation of my effort or a sense of, hey, I guess he does understand security and wants me to feel secure. I would love to put the whole thing under SSL and under EVSSL, but, you know, does that provide value to a blog owner? You know, I know that I see security consultants tend to use PGP certificates and they sign their email. And I'm always impressed simply because of the amount of effort required to get it to work correctly, not because necessarily that I'm talking to, you know, that I care about the little cert. I just go, oh, wow, that person jumped through the hoops in order to get this little ribbon to show up in his email.
I just wish I had things that were impressive enough in my email to require that sort of encryption. But, you know, the blog sites is an interesting one, and certainly it's been asked of me a few times, you know, hey, you keep writing about SSL, but look at your blog. It's all HTTP. And it's, you know, look, it is a good question, and I did actually have a good think about it. I thought, well, you know, look, there's an integrity question. Okay, so people could actually change what's on my blog. You know, really, how are you going to commoditize that? You can only get, you know, you can only sort of be a man in the middle in certain locations. If you get, you know, a few people at a conference on the Wi-Fi, it's not going to exactly be a big deal. Nobody's sort of submitting things that are sensitive. The best I could come up with was I used Discuss comments on my blog, and Discuss does seem to send their authentication cookies backwards and forwards in the clear, which is a bit of a risk. But this is something that Discuss needs to fix as well. You know, it's something that sort of falls back to them.
It would be interesting to see if you use protocol relative URLs to load Discuss, do they have a valid certificate? So if you use SSL, would things work themselves out?
Yeah, that would be a good question. That may well happen. And of course, you could just embed Discuss over HTTPS and see what it does as well. So that would be a good question. The other thing is, you know, look, if you're going to go to SSL, it's a question of, you know, many of us, like myself, I mean, I run on Blogger, for example. I'm not sure that Blogger actually has the facilities to support that. So short of me going to a blogging platform I can run myself and whack it up on an Azure site and put my own certificate on it, you know, you've got to get support from the other players that are involved in the blog.
Indeed. And all of this requires effort. I think that's the takeaway, that you need to at least put thought into it. So if you choose not to do something, that you know why you chose not to, and it was a conscious decision and not simply one of laziness.
Yeah, I think that really nails it. And you know, a really good example of that is Stack Overflow. So Stack Overflow, who many of your listeners probably use pretty religiously, like myself, when you log on, particularly when you log on with one of the third-party authentication providers, everything is secure and it's all great. And then you get back to Stack Overflow and it's all over HTTP. So your Stack Overflow authentication cookie, for example, is HTTP. If you get a man in the middle while you're browsing Stack Overflow, they can copy that cookie and they can become you. So, you know, upvote things, leave ridiculous comments. You know, they can do whatever they want. Now, in a case like that, the guys understand absolutely 100% what the risk is and what's involved in moving from HTTP over to HTTPS. So, you know, I think that's a good example of where they've made a very conscious decision about what would be involved. And in fact, Nick Craver from Stack Overflow wrote a post just a few weeks ago where he talks about all of the things that need to fall into place for a sort of top 200 website like theirs to move. So, you know, they've got to get all their third-party content providers to make sure that things like ads and avatars and any inline videos or images are served over HTTPS. They've got to consider CDNs and load balancers and multiple domains. I mean, there's a whole lot of work, and it sounds like those guys are going to go down that path anyway, but at least it's a conscious process. You know, it's not just sort of, we did this because we didn't know any better.
Wow. Well, you can read about all of these exploits and ideas and things that Troy is thinking about and security at troyhunt.com. Thanks for chatting with me today.
Thanks very much, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.